Welcome to the Peter King Podcast. So it's an interesting podcast this week, kind of reflective of the times we're living in, and also of what's going on in football. You know, it's interesting. I tweeted the other day that I felt foolish writing a 9,000 word column about football, because football's obviously so unimportant these days. But a lot of you reached out both on Twitter and via email to say that, you know, we all need something else today, something to take our minds off of the thing that's always on our minds. So here goes this week's podcast with mostly football and a little side of the coronavirus. My guests are New Orleans Saints general manager Mickey Loomis on all things football and running an organization, all from remote areas. Loomis will join me from his home. I'm also going to have a former ESPN reporter. You may remember her. Her name is Kaylee Hartung. She worked for ESPN doing a lot of college football for 5 years. And now she's in news. She's an ABC News correspondent based in Los Angeles, who currently is getting over a bout of her own with the coronavirus, which she almost certainly picked up while doing some reporting in Seattle for ABC News. And then finally, we're going to put a bow on all of the Tom Brady discussion with the man who's been ahead of the curve all along, ESPN's Jeff Darlington. So, just a couple of things, really, about just a little bit about sort of how I view what we're doing in this business, and maybe a little bit about how I view my role going forward in the next few weeks. I really do take it seriously what people say to me. Hey, listen, we need you. We need something else. I've gotten some tremendously heartfelt emails in the last few days, and I appreciate them so much, about how much you appreciate being able to spend 20 or 30 minutes getting away from the news of the day with sort of the news of recreation and sports, because there really isn't much going on in sports right now other than with the NFL. And so I appreciate that. And I am going to, in the coming weeks, both from my podcast and from the writing that I do at NBCSports.com, I'm going to give you as much as I can of both, of trying to be a little bit human and also trying to tell you everything you need to know about the sport that you love so much, and that's football. So that's how I'm going to proceed in the next few weeks, and I really want to hear from you. I want to hear from you. It's really important. What do you want? What are you interested in? This podcast, for instance, I have the ability to talk to a lot of people in and around the NFL. It's a little bit more difficult now because some of the people in the NFL are being a little bit reclusive now because they feel, as one general manager told me last week, and you'll hear a little about it from Mickey Loomis, they really don't want to be so much forward-facing right now, so much public-facing, because it's almost like they don't want to be seen as, oh my God, this is so important, what it is we're doing, because in many cases, they don't feel that it's important, but they're going on with the business of football nonetheless. So I would love to hear from you. My email address is, and I'll give it to you slowly, it's Peter King. FMIA. That's Peter King Football Morning in America. Peter King FMIA at gmail.com. And that Peter King FMIA has no dots, periods, dashes, anything. It's just Peter King FMIA at gmail.com. Tell me what you want to hear about. Tell me what you want to read about. And hopefully, I'll be able to serve a lot of your football and maybe even some of your needs away from football in the next few weeks. But for now, let's start this week's podcast. We're going to start it with Mickey Loomis, the general manager of the New Orleans Saints. Happy to be joined this week, a very topical guest this week, Mickey Loomis, the executive vice president and general manager of the New Orleans Saints, the former NFL executive of the year, with a lot going on, trying to run a football organization in the middle of this remotely. The governor of the state of Louisiana has closed all non-essential services and businesses in the state of Louisiana. So Mickey Loomis is going to be joining us from his home today. And Mickey, I'm not sure, but you still have some role, right, with the New Orleans Pelicans. So that probably just exacerbates the Pelicans now not playing basketball, obviously, with the NBA on hiatus.
Well, let me correct you first, Peter. So I'm no longer heading up the basketball operation. When we hired David Griffin to be general manager, and actually not general manager, but head of basketball operations for the Pelicans, I ceded that back to him. So we ceded okay. that back to him. So my involvement with the Pelicans is pretty minimal at this point. And look, David's done a great job with that club, and we're excited about the future of the Pelicans. And he and I communicate a lot about you know, managing our respective teams. But yeah, listen, the difficulty when you're in season is exponentially bigger than that when you're in the off season.
And obviously the Pelicans and the Saints, you guys share a training facility, right?
Well, their building is on our campus across the parking lot. So we're, you know, we see each other often.
At this point, when you look at what has happened, sort of, it's been obviously an odd free agency signing period. You know, your coach Sean Payton actually contracted coronavirus. What has this offseason so far been like for you as you have attempted to have some bit of normalcy through free agency and draft preparation?
Well, I'd say, first of all, it's not normal. I don't think anything about it is really normal because, you know, of the circumstances. Obviously it's difficult when you're not together, you're not in the building, you're not, you know, trading opinions back and forth. But look, a lot of this work relative to free agency was done prior to the beginning of free agency in terms of evaluations and targets and guys that you wanted to re-sign. So, a large part of the evaluation process was primarily done. But, you know, the logistics and the actions that are necessary to you know, get a player signed, get physicals, all that has changed pretty dramatically. And yet, I hate to even talk about any difficulty or anything that relates to our business when, you know, we have healthcare workers and people that are out on the front lines of this battle who have real problems, you know, compared to what we have to deal with.
And what exactly is your team doing right now? Do you have everybody or just most people working remotely right now?
Yeah, look, the state of Louisiana, the governor just yesterday, you know, basically shut down non-essential businesses as of 5 o'clock yesterday. So we were already probably in the 80-90% mode of people that were working remotely, and now it's just, you know, just a few people that are essential that have to you know, be in the building. Not very many at all, though. We're trying to comply and respect the governor's orders, and so it's almost exclusively remote.
Would you say that in a practical sense, do you think it's going to be difficult to draft a month from now, April 23rd, without, you know, almost certainly now, without having much exposure at all to players between now and the draft?
Well, I would say this. Look, this is my own opinion. My own opinion is that it will be really difficult, and I'd be personally in favor of delaying the draft so that we can get some of the work done that our scouts and our personnel people ordinarily do, and then just the logistics of trying to conduct the draft with you're not having access to your draft rooms and your offices, creates a lot of logistic problems. This is not a fantasy draft that you conduct out there with just a list of things on a piece of paper. There's a lot of work that goes into it to prepare, and there's a lot of work that is done during the draft it'll be very, very difficult to conduct that and do it in a way that you're doing justice to the process.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'd be surprised if this draft was held, on April 23rd, 24th, and 25th. And as one of your peers told me the other day about the difficulty of, holding a draft under the current circumstances, he said, look, I mean, we all believe that the Bengals are going to draft Joe Burrow, and they probably should. But how would you like to be the Bengals and to be the head coach of the Bengals and have spent a total of 15 minutes in your life with the guy you were about to make the first pick of the draft and the franchise quarterback of your team? He said, I don't know when that last happened. It would have to be almost decades ago that you would have spent so little time with the guy you're basically going to hand the keys to your team to.
Yeah, I mean, that's I couldn't put it any better than that. And look, to varying degrees, that exists throughout the draft, that there's a large part of the information gathering process hasn't happened yet. And a lot of that gets done in the months of March and early part of April. And obviously we haven't been able to do that. It doesn't make it impossible, and yet it makes it much more of a gamble, I guess, much riskier than it would be ordinarily. That's just the simple way to say it.
I want to just ask you a little bit, even though it's at this point, you can talk about all this other stuff all day, but for those who are Saints fans, I think that they have to be impressed by two things that have happened in the free agency period. And one is bringing Malcolm Jenkins back. Sean Payton and you have often said this was a guy who really was a valuable, valuable contributor to your great Saints teams. Payton said it was the one guy he really regretted letting go. And not only that, but you were able to help your receiving core with Emmanuel Sanders. So tell me just a little bit, if you can, about your design going into free agency, and how was it that you were able to focus and get focus on and get these two guys?
Good question. First of all, with Malcolm, I'd be the first one to say that we should never let him out of the building. And look, that's my responsibility more than anyone's. He was the epitome of what you want as a leader and a player. For us, for the first 5 years of his career, and obviously did that more in Philadelphia over the last however number of years it's been. So to get him back into our building is really a blessing as much as anything else. I'm looking forward to having him in our building again. Look, we expect great play. We know we're going to get great play from him, but we also know that he's a positive addition in terms of leadership in the locker room. But yet, listen, he was still under contract to the Eagles all the way up to, you know, just really the day before that we were able to get an agreement with him. So that wasn't something that was expected going into free agency. But, you know, he came available and it happened and we're excited to have him. You know, Emmanuel Sanders, I think, listen, we've always felt like Emmanuel Sanders is a quality player. We talked about a year ago or during last season when it looked like he might be traded. Look, we talked about that. We tried to find a way that, hey, can we make this happen? You know, how can we make this work relative to, you know, the compensation that was required as well as, you know, his salary cap numbers, and we just couldn't make that work. So, listen, it got to the point where there was a desire on both his part and our part, and we found a way to, you know, create resources in order to get him in the building. And look, we're really excited about it. It'll be a nice compliment to the other weapons that we have on offense. Man, there's another guy too that I look forward, because I think he's going to be a positive addition, not just on the field, but in terms of the locker room and the leadership that he can provide as a veteran player.
I don't know where it would happen or when you would do it, but there needs to be a salary cap class taught somewhere, and you need to be the professor, because every year, I'm serious, every year you do more with the cap, and I keep waiting for you guys to get killed one of these years, and yet you don't. You know, like this year, you bring Andres Pete back, you know, a very valuable offensive lineman. You know, you're able to bring in Jenkins and bring in Sanders and re-sign Drew Brees. Now, this is a ridiculously, you can't answer this question in a paragraph, and unfortunately, I'm asking you to do it. But what would you say is your secret and or your philosophy to massaging and handling the cap the way you guys do?
Well, there's no secret, number one. Look, lots of teams do a great job of managing their cap, and you know, part of this is look, we've been fortunate a number of times, but we've also made plenty of mistakes, plenty of them that are on my shoulders. So, look, some of it is when you have a quarterback like Drew and you have a head coach like Sean, who can take advantage of the things that are in the building, they cover up a lot of mistakes. And so that's number one. I think, you know, for this year, look, Drew has taken less money than he could probably command if he wanted to. No question about it. And that's to the benefit of the team. So look, there's, we've been in this mode over the last, you know, I don't know how many years now of trying to take advantage of the window of opportunity that we have with Drew. And so that causes you to say, look, we need to borrow some resources from future years. We need to, you know, be disciplined in where and how much we're paying in certain areas. And look, let's make sure that we're creating an environment that players want to be part of and are willing to take, you know, not a lot less, but a shade less than they could command elsewhere. And so I think the environment that our head coach and our ownership has created here, you know, lends itself to that. We've had plenty of players that have you know, recognized that and taken a shade less than they can command, and we appreciate that. And hopefully they're rewarded, you know, in terms of the environment and the success that we've had.
Finishing up with Mickey Loomis, Mickey, I'll end with this. You're headed into a year that is going to be difficult for, I think, everybody. No one knows when or if there will be an off-season program, when the draft might be, you know, anything like that. When training camp, I think everybody is hoping the season starts on time, but who knows? What is your, you know, when people around your organization ask, you know, hey, what's the future like? What, you know, how are we going to handle this? because I'm sure everybody is wondering, just like you are, what do you say to them?
Well, good question. I think first of all, I think we need to make sure we're not tone deaf to what's going on in the world. The entire world has been basically put on pause, and rightfully so. I tell our guys the same thing, is that our number one concern is your safety and the well-being of your families, and that's certainly ahead of any of our NFL responsibilities. At the same time, we can discuss and we can make plans about how things are going to move forward given the circumstances that we have, and yet recognizing that that can change from day to day. So, I think just having a perspective more than anything else is important here. And I feel like, I feel like our building, our people, and I think the people around the NFL are really well equipped to handle adversity. And so I think so far, as a league, I think we've done that pretty well. And we'll continue to prepare for the logistics and the things that have to happen in order to ramp up quickly to either have an off-season program or a training camp or the draft, as you previously mentioned. And then certainly we're hopeful that the games will be, and the schedule will be played on time. But look, we're just like everyone else. We're adapting to this new normal, and we just hope that the new normal doesn't last very long.
Mickey Loomis, so good of you to join me on the podcast this week. Really appreciate it. Good luck to the Saints, and most importantly, good luck to the people of New Orleans.
Thank you, Peter. And look, the same thing to you and to all your listeners. Look, stay well, stay healthy, and I think we'll all just be fine.
And now from Los Angeles, joining me is Kaylee Hartung, who's an ABC News correspondent based in Los Angeles. As I said at the top, many of you got to know her when she worked for ESPN for 5 years covering college football. Many of you will remember Kaylee because she worked for ESPN for 5 years. You saw her covering an awful lot of college football. So she left ESPN and went to CNN for a couple of years. And last year, 2019, she became a correspondent for ABC News. She is now an ABC News correspondent based in Los Angeles. And my wife and I are news junkies. And so we watch the ABC Nightly News as well as the NBC Nightly News. And so every night, for the past few months, occasionally there would be Kaylee Hartung. And I said, hey, I never knew Kaylee, but she used to cover sports. So I kind of followed you a little bit. And then I saw you in Seattle at the nursing facility that had all the COVID-19 illnesses and unfortunately deaths. You reported from there. And then more recently, I saw that you actually came down with COVID-19. And so I honestly, Kaylee, I just kind of wanted to talk to you a little bit about how you're doing and to hear your story and maybe to talk about how people should approach this right now. So thanks a lot for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Peter. I appreciate your thoughtfulness and your concern, and I'm glad to report that I am feeling well now, and I'm on the other side of this, but it was now 13 days ago that I first felt the onset of symptoms, and at that point, I was 4 days removed from having been in Seattle for a week covering the initial outbreak of the virus in the U.S., and so I was on heightened alert for how I would be feeling. But at first, when I just had a runny nose and kind of woke up with a sore back, I explained away the symptoms. I thought the runny nose was just allergies. And when it came to the tightness in my back, I thought maybe I just slept wrong. But the following day, this was last Thursday, now almost 2 weeks ago, I woke up, and as soon as I did, I knew something was wrong. I think we've all had that feeling before when you have the flu or when you've just gotten run down and your body starts to shut down on you, where you just feel it in your body as soon as you wake up that something's not right. I had that feeling, and I had a headache just right between the eyes that wouldn't go away. I had those body aches really escalating to a point of pain in my lower back, a tightness in my lower back like I've never felt before. Like I was a wind-up doll and somebody was just taking the key and turning it and turning it and turning it. And then at one point I had chills. I laid down in bed in the middle of the day and fell asleep, woke up 2, maybe 3 hours later, and I was in a full sweat. So at some point a fever spiked there, but only for a brief while. But what I noticed in the midst of all of this was that I wasn't having the symptoms that at that time were being so closely associated with having COVID-19. I wasn't coughing. I didn't have that dry cough that's been described, and I didn't have any shortness of breath. I wasn't experiencing any respiratory difficulty. But nevertheless, of course, I called my bosses at ABC News, and we got our chief medical expert, Jennifer Ashton, on the phone, and the consensus was unanimous amongst them. I needed to get tested. And that started a journey of just hours and hours on the phone, an incredibly frustrating and confusing process of trying to figure out just how to get tested. And by the next morning, I was in an emergency room here in Los Angeles, finally getting that test.
So I want to go back. Let me start at the beginning. You get assigned by ABC to go up to Seattle. And at the time, obviously, the coronavirus is just starting to really percolate in the United States. I think the first death was around.
The reason I went to Seattle was because the first death in the United States had just happened in Washington State.
Yeah, February 29th.
So the very first report I did, exactly, yeah. I actually watched that first report I did back a couple of days ago, and it was so hard to put myself back in that moment and think, you know, how little we knew, and to try to wrap my mind around the toll that this virus has taken on the country in the meantime.
When you got assigned, were you scared?
I wasn't scared so much as I was wanting to be smart about how we operated. I had ABC's medical expert on the phone with me in the hospital. I mean, as I was in the airport heading to Seattle, and I called her and said, how concerned do I need to be? And what precautions should I be taking? You know, I wanted to make sure that I was well informed in that vein. And in that moment, she said, my concern for you is like a 2 on a scale of 10. She said, what you need to be more conscious of than anything is where you are putting your hands. She was like, surfaces, doorknobs, be so vigilant about what you're touching. And I, you know, tried to really take that advice to heart. I was washing my hands with great frequency. I had, you know, hand sanitizer in my purse at every turn. Was trying not to get too close to anybody. And of course, we were having the conversations with people there about who'd been exposed at the nursing home, and all of that, because it was just unfolding, and the nursing home had just gone on its own sort of lockdown to keep visitors out. But I know that I was talking with family members who have loved ones there who'd been in the nursing home as recently as 2 or 3 days before then. So the guidelines for us were, you know, when we got back, were so long as you're not having any symptoms and so long as you haven't had contact with someone who's tested positive, you're fine. But in reality, looking back on it, we couldn't have known who had it. The people in the nursing home couldn't even get tested. I don't know why the guidelines were adhering so closely to the concept of who's already tested positive. Nobody was even getting tested at that point. We're still having trouble getting people tested at this point. But so to answer your question, I wasn't scared, because I had confidence that I'm young and healthy, and that if I did contract the virus, I would be okay. But now, considering that I've actually contracted the virus and I am okay, I feel luckier than I could have ever imagined feeling, because I've also had to cover stories of people my age and, you know, and my health going into ICU and having much more difficult experiences with this virus than I have had. And that's what I don't think people have quite wrapped their mind around. You know, I'm glad for people to hear my story and hear that you need to take these mild symptoms seriously and know that you can be okay on the other side and recognize the threat you could be as someone with mild symptoms to someone who is more susceptible to the virus attacking them. But, you know, the other side of that also is that young people are making up 20% of those in ICUs across this country right now.
Wow. So I watched a lot of the news reports from the Life Care Center in Kirkland, Washington. What was it actually like to be there and to have to work on the property?
Oh, it was emotionally draining in a way I've never experienced as a journalist before, because every day I had to watch ambulances pull into the parking lot and people taken out on stretchers, put into those ambulances, taken to the hospital, and then we'd hear the death toll had risen. And we were seeing that happen every day that we were there. There were faces to the numbers that we were reporting. I was meeting people who'd lost loved ones. It was heartbreaking on a level that I've never experienced before, because these families couldn't get answers. Whether it was one woman whose mother passed away and who hadn't been tested before she died because she had symptoms, and then was told her mother's body wouldn't be tested after she died because essentially, she's old and we'll chalk it up to natural causes. You know, I had to go to a press conference and press local officials to say, will you test this woman's body? And thankfully, they did.
Was that a coronavirus death?
You know, believe it or not, it was not. She tested negative. She actually tested negative, which I certainly didn't anticipate. But again, glad they tested her because we need that data. And then I also had to speak with family members who have loved ones inside who just felt trapped and who couldn't get tested in the first week that the place was on lockdown. So the thinking would be, rational, logical thinking would be, the longer you leave someone who doesn't have the virus in a petri dish where you know the virus is spreading, the greater their chances to contract it. And the fact that it took a week for everyone in there to be tested was just mind blowing. And I say all of that to say, I've never covered a story as a journalist before where I wanted so badly to help people who didn't have a voice get their message out and get answers from officials and hold officials accountable for the promises that they were making. And I, you know, my heart was hurting as we left Seattle, because I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to feel like I was deserting the people there who were still begging for answers. But it didn't come as a surprise to anybody that when the outbreak really spread in New York City, the focus of the story, the focus of the country turned away, unfortunately, from that nursing home in Seattle.
How do you feel right now, today, on Tuesday, March 24?
I feel well. I really do. I mean, at this point, I've been in my apartment alone for 13 days. So there's a toll that takes on you. But no, I really do physically feel well, and I've got plenty to keep me busy. I feel relief that my symptoms are gone. I think more emotionally exhausted at this point than physically exhausted. And honestly, I think my anxiety has risen from a level of being selfish, worried about my own condition, to really now taking some time to wrap my mind around the state that our country is in and the shutdown that our businesses are in and the bleak outlook for our economy. You know, since I've been trapped inside, the world has changed. And that is really hard for me to understand when I am not having, you know, person-to-person contact with anyone, or seeing what the lines look like at the grocery stores, or seeing what the streets look like empty. I haven't had that experience yet.
what would you want people in the United States to know about COVID-19?
I think my message is that it's kind of a two-parter. One being that these mild symptoms have to be taken seriously. I don't think there are any coincidences in how any of us are feeling right now. If there's something off with your body, I think you need to assume that it's coronavirus. I know that getting a test is the most difficult part of this process for a lot of us. That uncertainty is breeds anxiety, but I think we all need to come to terms with just assuming if anything is wrong with your body right now, let's call it coronavirus, and you need to be isolating yourself. I think the quicker we take these guidelines and regulations and advisements seriously, the quicker we all lock down, the quicker we're going to get past this. If people don't take this seriously, if people don't stay home as much as they possibly physically can, this virus is going to continue to spread. And I think if we all got serious about it, we could get through this a lot faster. I think the longer we're in some version of purgatory where we feel like our lives are being inconvenienced and feel some need to get out and about and, you know, live our lives in some sense of normalcy, like the longer we're going to be stuck in this strange, strange world we're living in right now. And at the end of the day, this is about all of us taking care of each other. I had to explain to my family that my health was not my concern. I was going to be fine. My greatest concern was the danger I could put someone else in. And I think if we can all think of it that way, that our any selfishness we have of going out and about is putting other people in danger more than anything.
What have you done to avoid going stir crazy?
You know, strangely enough, this is going to sound so, so cheesy, but I mean it from the bottom of my heart. In isolation, I have not felt lonely. I think in sharing my story, I really hoped that I could help people learn from my experience. But what I didn't anticipate was the concern that other people would have for me, you know, people who love me, people who care about me. And so as a result of that, I have had this tremendous outpouring of love and support and communication with folks. And so that has kept me busy, whether it's on the phone or FaceTime. I just learned about Zoom a couple of days ago. But that's been really nice. And on top of that, I just moved into a new apartment in LA. So I've had plenty of time that I never would have imagined having to get stuff done around here, organize things. I mean, I'm talking about emptying out a box full of toiletries and separating products into categories and throwing away things that I don't need. I've had more time than I could have imagined to take on some of these tasks. But, you know, we always say, oh, one day we'll do this, one day we'll do that. Well, by the time this is all over and I escape this apartment, the organization level is going to be unlike anything I've ever had before. So I've stayed plenty busy. And then the other part of it is, I've still been contributing to ABC News as best I could between my relationships with people in Seattle and the families at Life Care. And tonight I've got a piece for World News. So I'm staying busy, and I'm grateful to have all of these sort of tasks and activities to keep me occupied.
We'll end with this. Are you glad you left sports? Do you miss sports? Are you happy to be in news?
I miss my old job at ESPN every day. I miss being a part of those incredible moments in the sports world that I just took great. I had a great sense of pride, and I think I really felt honored to be able to share in some of those moments of achievement and tell the stories that could make fans feel closer to their favorite teams. But as I see it, I get asked this question all the time, and as I see it, my goal was never to leave sports and go to news. My goal is to be building a broader foundation for myself so that as my career progresses, I can do it all. that's my goal. I don't ever want to feel like I've left sports completely. I hope that there comes a time in the not so distant future that I'm able to be involved again and have my platform with ABC News as well, and just be able to be a great storyteller no matter the sphere we're talking about, whether it's sports or news.
Kaylee Hartung, it's been really fun to meet you and chat with you, even though it is by a telephone/Zoom line, and look forward to meeting you one day. But I must say that I really applaud, you know, your thought about doing everything, because I think that will serve you so well in the next 8 or 10 or 12 or 15 years, just because you will be one of the most versatile people in our business.
That is the goal. I really appreciate you saying that, Peter. And truthfully, I am a huge fan of yours. I love reading your work, and I am really grateful for your time and your interest here and your kind words. And I look forward to meeting sometime soon.
Hey, all the best to you, Kaylee. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Peter.
And now my conversation with ESPN's Jeff Darlington. Jeff, as most of you know who follow the NFL, has been very close to the Tom Brady story throughout. And Jeff, I guess I would begin by asking you whether anything that happened in him going to Tampa surprised you.
Stunned, I believe, is the word, Peter, that apparently set off some alarms when I said it. And no, honestly, not much did surprise me. I just, and maybe it was the fact that I kind of had a longer amount of time than most to sort of digest the likelihood, just based on my knowledge of the situation, that he would be leaving. So that it wasn't a surprise that he left, nor was it a surprise that he would choose somewhere that was not necessarily a big market team. It was never going to be, in my opinion, based on what I knew, about trying to find a better place or a better city. For Tom, it was just finding a place that, quite frankly, made him happy.
And I sort of followed your trail on this. You said it first, maybe about 2 months ago, that, and I agreed with you, but I didn't know exactly how true it was until really very recently. And that is that in many ways, Tom Brady was looking for another football experience. This is not mm-hmm. necessarily about I hate Belichick, or man, the Patriots were cheap, or anything like that. This is more, I think it's a little bit more about a new football experience, a new life experience, and basically seeing what life is like on the outside of Foxborough. And I know a lot of people mm-hmm. would say, well, that's crazy. He was part of the greatest organization. Why in the world would you leave it? You're not winning a Super Bowl in Tampa. But you said, and I think you're absolutely right, that this is about a little bit more than just a place where you think for the next 2 years you have the best chance to win a Super Bowl.
Yeah, and I think both of those things can be somewhat true, in the sense that, yes, look, if the Patriots, and more specifically Bill Belichick, sort of showed him the love in ways that didn't get him to the point where he was looking to be reinvigorated, then maybe he would have stayed. So in some sense, that is true. But at some point, there was that crossroad where it was as if it did shift into, you know what, like, rather than focus on sort of the annoyances that I'm facing, that the things that maybe displeasure me, why not look at this as an opportunity at 42 years old to just try something different? And I think it's so hard for everybody, and I get why, that someone would be in something for 20 years and then just in this last, you know, it's like you're golfing for a full round and you're playing unbelievably well through 16 holes, and then you just totally change everything you were doing for the last two holes. And I get why maybe that doesn't calculate well with people, but for Tom Brady, he just got to a place that he said, why not? I got one life. I got one body. Why not just to see what I can do with it and challenge myself in a way that will potentially make me happy?
I think one of the things that I have realized throughout this process is, and I remember, I kind of compare this to what happened to Jerry Rice when he was 42 years old. Jerry Rice went to training camp with the Denver Broncos. And at training camp, he was not doing well. And one day when I was at this camp, Mike Shanahan was still coaching the team, a free agent cornerback out of the Mid-American Conference, a rookie, was guarding Jerry Rice. And on two snaps in a row, Rice couldn't get any separation. And so you just felt like it's not going to be long. But there were a lot of people in the business, both in the football business and media business, who said, man, Rice is really tarnishing his reputation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's not a soul today, A, who remembers that Jerry Rice was even camp with the Denver Broncos. And I don't know. I had a totally different opinion. I thought, you know, good for him. He loves football. Let him do this. And so, like, when I hear Terry Bradshaw say, why in the world would he do this? Just either retire or go play for the Patriots. You know, I mean, not everybody is like you, Terry Bradshaw. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, it's okay if somebody wants to go and do something new and different.
But I think that's one of the more fascinating elements to this whole thing to me is that so many people feel so strongly about what one person should ultimately determine to do when what he is determining has no like true impact on anybody's life but his own in some capacities, you know. Yeah. And it is a little odd to me that like we're so like, why would Tom's an idiot? Why would he ever do this? It's like, maybe he wants to. Maybe it's just that he wants to. And to your point about Jerry Rice, you know, maybe we don't remember these final 2 years in the grand scheme of things. Maybe they are just a very brief mention in the career of Tom Brady. The one thing that will interest me though is he couldn't have picked a better team, and I don't think that he did this deliberately, to be honest. But he couldn't have picked a better team that if he were to go win there, the roster is probably pretty underrated. And I think we're all starting to now. I was joking with somebody with the Bucks. They said, man, all of a sudden Tom Brady signs and everybody thinks they actually have a good defense. And it's kind of funny how all of a sudden the Bucks are a little bit more of a favorite. But in some capacity, I think that that if Tom were to go do this and succeed with the Bucks, I mean, man, that puts a stamp on things. So while I don't think he's doing that necessarily deliberately, I do certainly think that he can really prove a lot if he does succeed in Tampa.
Hey, look, this is a team that was 7-7 with 2 weeks to go. They were on a four-game winning streak. They had two home games left, a Saturday home game against Houston and then a Sunday game to end the season against Atlanta. They outplayed the Texans and lost. They outplayed Atlanta and lost. And they lost because Jameis Winston threw six interceptions in those two games, including a walk-off pick six on the last throw of his Tampa career in overtime against the Falcons. So I do not look at this as Tom Brady's going to the Cleveland Browns. I look at it like Tom Brady is going to a team that when you sit down, and we all do this, when we sit down after the draft and before training camp, we say, okay, what teams are making that jump this year? Yeah. I guarantee you, I've been thinking about this all spring, even long before I knew who was going to quarterback them. If Teddy Bridgewater was going to be the quarterback of the Bucks this year, I would have had them being one of my teams. You know, because I think they have a bunch of other things in place. I'm not saying they'll be what San Francisco was last year, but I think they have a chance to make the kind of jump from 7-9 to the playoffs that, you know, that that a team like San Francisco made last year. So anyway, we'll see.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and to that point, you know, when we talk about whether people have been asking me whether I'm surprised about the Bucks, and again, maybe I've had a little bit more time. I'm sure that you've talked to a lot of these people as well, but I mean, going back to like mid-February, I remember having a conversation with someone in the organization about, you know, kind of saying like, hey, man, I think Tom Brady's pretty serious about this free agency thing. You know, you might want to really like not count yourselves out if you guys were interested. And all of a sudden, you know, during this conversation, you start to talk about the things that the Bucks have. And you start to convince not only yourself, but the organization starts to sort of believe in themselves when they're saying, man, when you really list the assets and the pros of what we do have, maybe we are a veteran efficient quarterback away. And I think that now we're kind of seeing that.
Jeff, my favorite note in my column on Monday when I was writing about Brady was this: Brady's passer rating in his 20s, 88.4. Brady's passer rating in his 40s, 96.0. I sort of view this as, even though it's a little bit of a gamble for the Bucks, man, it's a gamble. Yeah. I would have taken 8 days a week.
Hell yeah. Why not? I mean, and that's another thing. Like, again, I think we're so prone to take these things so seriously, and everybody wants, you know, ultimately this is about fun and entertainment. And like, what is more entertaining than seeing Tom go to this team and see the Bucks sign him and sort of invigorate their own fan base, whether it's for a couple years or whatever. And that was sort of another thing when people were saying like, oh, why would teams want Tom Brady? It's like, are you kidding me? Like, why not? It's fun. And you know what? Blow up, like, you know, if you're some team that has these plans to kind of grow and develop into this blueprint organization, like, how often does that really work? So if it means that you can go get a quarterback who's the greatest of all time for the final years of his career, I don't know. Again, maybe I'm looking at this like too liberally, but I just think it's fun.
Yeah, I do too. I also think, you know, one of the other things I talked a little bit about in my column this week was, when something like this happens, everybody wants to figure out the reason why it happened. They want to blame somebody. And as I said, I don't fault Belichick. I don't fault Brady. So this is really just life. This is not,
yeah.
I mean, look, I there's no doubt in my mind Belichick could have stopped this from happening if he wanted,
yeah.
If he really wanted to, but does he want to? I mean, you know, yeah. Bill Belichick in his 26 years as a coach, or however long it's
right.
been, my team bends to no one. And there would have had to have been a tremendous financial sacrifice on the cap for the Patriots to do this. And at some point, Tom Brady's dad was right 5-6 years ago when he said, you watch, you know, it's going to end ugly because – you know, Bill Belichick is not going to keep a guy, no matter how sentimental the feeling for him and that fan base might be. He's not going to keep a guy unless he feels like he's still playing well and is worth whatever right. he would pay him.
Well, and I'm glad to see, I mean, I know that there's been some sort of, there's certainly been conversation, especially, you know, when it comes to some of the hot takes and, you know, the debate shows and whatnot about who's at fault, Belichick or Brady. But generally speaking, even in New England, like, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I don't see people burning jerseys or pissed off at either guy necessarily.
Right.
I think that most people sort of are a little bit sad that it's over, but not to the degree that it's like, you know, just it doesn't feel like there's crazy animosity one way or the other. And I think that that's a good thing, even though could this have ended differently? Sure, to your point. It could have, but then again, it could have ended differently. Honestly, the last time around, what was that, 2017, before they got the other Super Bowl? So, I mean, it really could have potentially ended there. So the fact that you get another Super Bowl out of it and you kind of made it work a little longer, like, again, I think that that's, I don't know, I think it's a good thing. Maybe I'm too happy today. I don't know why, but I'm not feeling the anger today.
What is it about this story that you think that people might have gotten wrong? What is it about this story that if you were telling somebody about it, what would you emphasize? What would you stress?
Oh, that's a good question. There were definitely some misguided narratives. I think that going back, and a lot of the times when I had to kind of bite my tongue, I remember, and this is not a knock against Keyshawn Johnson. I'm using him more as an example of, because it happened a lot. I remember I was on Get Up with him, and I was kind of saying, like, you know, things aren't great here, and Tom's, you know, likely to leave. And I've been saying that, and until the day that I really kind of said that I'd be stunned, I don't think that people were really understanding that I was saying it from a place of knowledge, even though I was right. trying to be as blunt as possible. And I remember Keyshawn saying to me, it's not going to happen. Like, Tom's going to go back to New England. He's just flirting with other teams. This is just for fun. And for whatever reason, I can't put my finger on exactly why. No one, and maybe Tom and Belichick and the Patriots are to blame, because they never are really overly honest about their emotions. They just sort of hide everything in the background, so that no one was really necessarily willing to believe that behind the scenes, this was growing and developing into what it was. So I think more than anything, probably it was just strange how emotional people got about their opinion on something when it wasn't necessarily based on fact. And it's not a big deal. It's just interesting in this sort of media landscape that we can't necessarily just sort of accept a possibility with a little bit more.
Well, it's almost like that Terry Bradshaw stuff that came out this week, where Terry told Ed Bouchette of The Athletic that, come on, what is Tom Brady doing? It's just, and you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but he basically says, you know, he should play for the Patriots, or what are you still trying to do doing playing? Just retire.
Well, I mean, there was another narrative, Peter, too. Sorry to cut you off. I didn't mean to do that. But there was another narrative where he said, where everybody was kind of saying, well, it's the Titans or the Patriots. It's the Chargers or the Patriots. It's the Bucks or the Patriots. And I thought that was equally fascinating, that nobody could get it out of their heads that it wasn't just like, this one fit, or he'll just go back. It was never going to be that. And I think that's part of the reason why people ultimately were surprised in the end. They just couldn't wrap their head around that it was not going to be the Patriots.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Jeff, one last thing. So going forward right now, what's the thing that, you know, you're somebody, and I think everybody both in the business and who follows pro football knows that you're pretty close to, to Tom and to the people who are in his orbit. I mean, what do you think is the thing that might be misunderstood about his friends, his family, and all those people who don't make the decision for him, but certainly are sounding boards for him?
I think that he is, I don't know, what I've learned about him, I think early on, I sort of, when I first started covering Tom, and I know that you obviously will laugh at this because you've covered him since the beginning, so you kind of grew, he grew with you. So for me, though, when I kind of started covering the league, he was a little bit of an untouchable already, like when I got to the national level, where I kind of like felt, I found myself sort of just veering away from anything that had to do with Tom Brady, because it just, how was I ever going to penetrate that universe? And I remember, I mean, look, and by the way, I think that Tom would laugh if you know, when he hears that we're like close, like that probably would make him laugh more than anything, that we're like buddies. I wish we were buddies. I mean, that seems like a fun person to have as a friend, but I do know a lot of the people, I know him and I know a lot of people around him, and I know them to just be very like, I hate to use this word, but just normal, just good people, just nice, fun people to be around. And I think that Tom, to that point, and maybe this is why people are fascinated by his willingness to do something like this, he's not maybe as, he's hyper competitive, But in his day-to-day existence, I don't think he's as serious. I think he's a pretty normal guy in a lot of contexts. You know, he is an exceptional human in many regards. But in general, I think he's just a normal person. And when we kind of turn that into this story and what's happening here, I think this is, like, if you think of it just as a guy who's kind of, like, at his job and a little tired of it and kind of wants to be invigorated, maybe a little tired of his boss. Like, if you put yourself in that normal guy's sort of shoes, I think that maybe you'll look at this a little bit differently and a little bit more the way that Tom is doing it.
I think that's a really good point to make. You know, the other thing about how he's a normal guy, I mean, this is a guy who sends Chinese proverbs to his friends. You know, he texts them, and it just doesn't really fit the mold of an NFL quarterback, but he's sort of a Zen guy as much as anybody that I've been around in the NFL, you know?
I remember, Peter, before I interviewed him 2 years ago before his Super Bowl, which was, you know, by all means a highlight of my career, the highlight of my career in terms of, like, I mean, that was it. I was sitting down with Tom Brady, the greatest of all time, for an interview that was to air Super Bowl Sunday. And I was going to get like 10 minutes with him, and I had to make the most of it. And I was kind of surveying his friends for advice on how to handle it. Some guys were giving me very serious advice. But one guy was like, man, just like understand that the other day, like, you know, I was with Tom, we're just scrolling through his Instagram, like going through and looking at, the, you know, the jokes and the memes, just like the rest of us do. So like when you go in there, just remember, like, he's still a human. He's just a normal guy.
Yeah.
And again, I just come back to, he is exceptional in so many regards, but when it comes to his life and his pursuit of happiness, he's a lot like the rest of us.
Jeff Darlington of ESPN, thank you so much for joining me, and thanks for so much of your reporting on this, which was so spot on and educational for, you know, for, you know, basically for people who follow pro football and who are nutty about it. I think it sort of got us on the road to understanding that there's a good chance Brady was going to be out. And you stood alone in the wilderness for a while, but at the end, at the end you prospered. So congratulations.
Well, thanks, Peter. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on too.
My thanks to Mickey Loomis, Kaylee Hartung, and Jeff Darlington, all for their expertise and, in a week like this, also for their humanity. Also, if you're interested in more football content, this week, Chris Sims has his quarterback draft rankings. Okay, so if you're wondering if Jordan Love of Utah State is going to be a great player or a bust, and you're worried about where any of these high-profile quarterbacks are going or where they should go, Chris Sims has it all for you on the latest edition of the Sims Unbuttoned podcast. Also this week, we are all over at NBCSports.com, all over the postponement of the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo until 2021. Mike Tirico has some excellent interviews this week. He's got the Mike Tirico podcast, as well as interviews on the NBC Sports YouTube page. You can hear Mike Tirico with U.S. Olympic beach volleyball player Kerry Walsh Jennings, and also with swimmer Nathan Adrian. Many other interviews and a lot of good perspective from Mike Tirico. Remember, Mike Tirico was going to be the face of the Olympics in 2020. That obviously now shifts to 2021, but a lot of valuable content from Mike Tirico, both on the Mike Tirico podcast and on the NBC Sports YouTube page. So, thanks so much for listening this week. It's a little bit longer podcast than usual, but I've heard that you might have some time on your hands. So thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back next week. Remember, PeterKingFMIA@gmail.com. send me your ideas, your thoughts. Who do you want to hear from? I'm going to try to bring those people to you in the coming weeks.